Quick update. I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a two-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.
Hi, I'm Cole Cornford, and this is Secured, the podcast that dives deep into the world of application security. In this bonus episode, I speak with Toby Amodio, Chief Information Security Officer at the Department of Parliamentary Services, about the latest updates to the Information Security Manual. The ISM, also known as the Bible, is a great reference for anyone looking to understand what threats the government is looking to address and where as a community we need to be more vigilant. So let's jump right into the latest changes to the ISM.
All right. Welcome. Thanks, mate.
Thank you, Cole. Today, the intent is to go through the June quarterly update of the Australian Cyber Bible, that is the Information Security Manual. I intend that hopefully others can follow along at home should they want to, because it's all released on the ACSC's website. But before we jump in, I just thought I'd do a little bit of a overview about the ISM. And so the purpose of the ISM is to provide strategic and operational guidance on how an organization can protect the systems and data from cyber threats. Now, that's the very dry approach, but as Cole, you and I would know from working in government, it can also become the compliance stick to whack the government's back. But as with many things put out by the ACSC over the last couple of years, it has developed into a really valuable resource for cyber intelligence and standards. And so looking at the changes that happen on a quarterly basis becomes a ritual for government, but could also be beneficial for the private sector to look at what they should be focusing on and what controls are good to focus on within their organisations. Now, the intention is in this piece to kind of focus on the key changes, the thoughts on them, the implementability, which isn't a word, but we'll make it a word, and the applicability to government and private sectors. Before we jump in, I wanted to thank those who contribute to the ISM. I know it sounds a bit dry, but we're probably going to make a few lol at their expense. And it is a valuable document, and it is something that we can use to improve the cyber posture of the whole country. So what did you think of the ISM before we jump into the core section, Cole?
So for reference for people on the podcast, I basically worked in federal government from about 2014-ish till 2018, I think around that period. And so it was a very different time period. The top four was what people would refer to, and we were just starting to get used to the Essential 8 coming out. The ISM didn't even really have the ability to distinguish between different tiers of sensitivity, whereas nowadays you actually think about applying risk instead of being told the red wires and the blue wires need to be separate. And I guess another thing I really like about reading the most recent update is they got technical writers in, and they've really focused on making their language very clear. And I know when I first started that it was a lot harder to actually comprehend why people were making these decisions, and it was quite lengthy. So it's not so much a King James as much as a pocket Bible nowadays, but I prefer that because I can take it with me when I need to. The most recent update, I think, I've really been enjoying watching from a distance what's been happening in the sphere, because I don't know, I'm a little bit of a guy who just likes to see what's happening in the space, to see what all my friends are being subjected to back in the public sector. I'm kind of clear the AppSec, you just, you know, do whatever modern programming stuff that people tell you to do, and YOLO, have some fun, try to keep up with all of the tech yahoos, but it's a little bit more structured in government, I find. So it's good to see where we're moving. And yeah, the most recent update's been, I actually liked reading through these.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. So the approach that we're going to take to jumping through them is the ISM is broken up into guideline sections, and the guideline sections provide the practical guidance on a domain of cybersecurity and how people can implement those to protect their systems. Now, before we jump in, I will note that a number of the updates, as Cole referenced, on the back of them having new tech writers and having people who are reading and diligently checking their work. And so instead of CVEs in the vulnerability space, I really call them CCEs, which is critical control errors, where it's a spelling mistake. So there are a number of critical control errors this year. that we will pass over, but there are a couple of interesting things to talk about.
I think it's actually really important that they are continuously working on improving the grammar and spelling of the document. I just have a bit of a stickler for it nowadays in how I do written communication, because if something's not, you know, I've seen what has changed from 2015 to 2023, and it's a remarkably different document. So I know right now the iterations are incredibly small, but where it is right now is such a big, makes a big difference to people who are coming at it and not having to like spend an enormous amount of time shifting through jargon or having to deal with like sentences that are 7 or 8 paragraphs long to try to comprehend what's going on, right? I think we still absolutely should say give congratulations to people over ACSC for understanding that clear communication is really important.
I couldn't agree more. And it's effectively crowdsourcing the assurance of our wording. And so I think that there's a lot to be said for crowdsourcing, whether it's in improving the grammar and the contextual reference of our controls or through to improving our code. And to what you said as well, where a full stop is or how a sentence is structured is not just critical for ensuring understanding, but it's very critical if you're getting audited, because that can be the life and death of how a control is interpreted. Which brings us to a perfect segue to the first guideline, is the guideline for cybersecurity incidents. Now, with the guideline for cybersecurity incidents, whilst there is one minor update based on wording, there is an update to ISM control 0140, which changed from being prescriptive about having to report to the CSC to now encouraging people to do as soon as practical. So that control, be it what it may, is a great control to ensure that the whole of the country gets visibility to the incidents that are going on, and then they can feed that back into the cyber threat intelligence and into this document being better. So whilst we don't need to go through it in depth, it is one of those controls that people are aware of. And if you're in the private or public sector, I do highly recommend that you report to the ACSC where you can around your cybersecurity incidents, because it makes us all better. The next guideline and section is guidelines for procurement and outsourcing, and nothing in cyber is more interesting than procuring and outsourcing. And so ISM control 1572 is focused on updated include notification clauses for changes in locations by hosting service providers. This is interesting because it's about making sure that you have a new contract that people can contact you when they're going to move your cloud services offshore. I don't know how effective this will be. It'd be interesting to see how enforceable this would be with some of the big agencies. And again, don't want to boil the ocean on it, but it is one of those controls where it's easy to write down, but maybe hard to implement. And I think that there's a couple more like that that we will really sink our teeth into. And I think that the first one we're probably going to sink our teeth into is control number 1163. Which is underneath the guidelines for security documentation. So this control update is to expand the continuous monitoring plan to drive the need for vulnerability and penetration testing as part of services prior to go live or at any significant change. It's a pretty robust implementation of validation, of active validation of services prior to deployment and throughout the life cycle. That's what's the continuing monitoring plan of an organization. I think given your space in AppSec, you probably got a position on how we can shift left rather than pen testing at the end, but I won't put words in your mouth. I've got some strong thoughts on this applicability.
This concerns me because I guess like it depends on what they classify as a service or a system, right? Because we have to think outside of the box of just like software applications. It could mean something like we're providing, you know, some kind of change to tax affairs, like a taxation system or some kind of ability to log in and do Medicare records or whatever. It's a system may not refer specifically to an application, but all the processes and stuff around it. In which case, yeah, I can kind of see that because you have a fixed point in time where that has to be delivered based on your legislation, and that seems okay. My problem is very clearly if the definition relates to some kind of software system, in which case, generally in my world, people are deploying, you know, multiple times per day, that even if you've got like remote frequent windows and stuff, there's just no ability to have assurance processes done by humans at the speed that people are iterating with their software. And, you know, if you've got, say, 40, 50 different development teams and they're all deploying 2 to 3 times per day, then you need 150 pen tests per day, where usually we say they're about 5 days each, right? And this pen test has to be on this one API that's probably had a spelling error update or and the contract's been amended to add an authorization header. Regardless, there's no way that can ever scale without investing in application security services. So we just don't have enough pen testers in Australia. And even if we decided to hire all of them into the federal government, which, you know, that'd be interesting, I still don't think we'd be able to meet this control.
Yeah, I agree. And it is one of those pieces where the whole concept of continuous monitoring and ongoing assurance is obviously essential. And this is a perfect example to me of how a compliance audit read of this could be overburdensome. And then the risk implementation becomes essential because it is really, as you said, how you define the system, how you scope what you're going to do. And so for implementability, I would say anyone who's reading this control should have a policy around their continuous monitoring implementation and which parts of this they're going to implement and not, and which systems within their environment they're going to apply them to and when. Because if you just were to blanketly apply this, as you said, you're going to just set yourself up to fail and not meet your own bar. But obviously the concept of doing continuous monitoring is essential to ensure systems don't drift from their compliant state. So do you see this as applicable within that private sector space?
Well, it depends. There's a few things to get put my policy hat on prior to go live and significant changes. So when we say go live, if we're talking about project delivery models, it's quite a big difference between we now have released Apple Pay or, you know, blocking pipes for Telstra or something, right? Or a new superannuation app. The go live for them is the project delivery date. It's not when the software is in the production environment. That's a very different case. But deployment of significant changes is the other piece. So if you're iterating on really small bits of content continuously, none of that's ever going to be significant. So theoretically, if you have modern engineering practices where you're committing code multiple times per day and it's running through CI and it is, you know, being deployed, if it passes all the tests, then that's not really that significant. It's more of those big bang projects where they say we're going to do 30 to 50 services are going to be modified and then we're going to do it, have an outage over the weekend, and pen test has to happen before that. So I can see us, like I see people trying to adhere to this in both public and private sector and getting really angry on that wording of what is a service, because this is a service, a software application is a service, doing bank telling is a service, support center stuff, and then what is go live, what is significant change. So, and I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess this is why I don't work in policy, right?
That's it. The devil will be in the definition. And you should know with that definition that the auditors, whether they're external or internal, will hold you to your own account usually. So where you set your bar will be where they hold you. So make sure you know where you're setting your bar and why you're setting it there. Because even the wording in there that talks about the fact that the penetration test should be undertaken at least annually, as you said, we don't have enough penetration testers to scale to that within federal government, let alone across the private sector. So what does that look like?
Yes, like just that risk management approach, right? Mm. So what matters to your business? And as a public sector person, there's going to be quite different conversation about what matters compared to a private sector one. But generally in the private sector is, how do I make money? And I guess if you're working in tax, it's the same question. How do I make it?
It's true. It's true.
But still, revenue is generally where you want to be looking at things that actually actively help your business to be able to earn money. And the other thing, I guess, is what is externally exposed. And lastly, like, what is a tremendous reputational operational impact for you to be able to earn money in the future? So I'd be kind of looking at those places using that risk-based approach that I feel like most cyber professionals have kind of picked up over time. But I don't see any way that this control would be able to be followed without at least having like some kind of like automated program for assurance in place. And at least if it's system-based, it like AppSec and vulnerability scanning or product security makes the most sense for me to invest in.
Yeah, I agree. Moving on, the next updates they did, I personally enjoyed, which was guidelines for personnel security. Which was 1852 and 1853, because they ensured that least privilege applies to both admin accounts and standard accounts, which I was surprised that had not already occurred. So we'll just leave that one there as a comment.
Yep, look, people forget about things. That's all right.
People forget about standard accounts and ensuring that standard accounts have least privilege too, but least privilege, just consider it to be good practice no matter where it is in your environment. The next section was focusing on guides for communication systems, and I found this one to be funny because our organization's really trying to push for going paperless, and this really hits to the risks of having paper. So the controls 1854, 589, 1854, and 1856 apply to MFDs, multifunctional devices, or weapons of multifunctional destruction, because we have seen a lot of issues across the environment with MFDs being configured wrong or being used as pivots into the environment. So what did you think about the changes and about its applicability in that private sector?
I guess it just really depends. In my view, I work for a lot of places that just are paperless, right? They just, either they are fully remote companies or have been operating in a way that like having a physical printing device is usually like a break class, what the hell, we've made a mistake kind of thing, rather than you have offices with a bunch of printers that people need to go to, right? So I feel like migrating people across to getting used to not interacting with it can just mitigate this risk and I guess you save the environment.
Yeah. Well, look, and I felt the same way, that it seems like they were trying to push that you needed, if you had multi-factor on your normal environment, you needed multi-factor on your printer. And Lord knows that MFDs aren't really going to love that.
Oh, that's just going to be like, I can't even imagine pulling out like my RSA token or something and then being like, yeah, okay, I'm going to punch these numbers in after already getting angry about paper jams or whatever. So like, I just... what they're trying to do is make it so hard that people just are never going to print documents again, right? You just can't comply with this. So we're just going to, we're done. Multifunctional devices are gone because it's too hard.
This is the nail in the multifunctional coffin.
Yeah, that's it.
I wish that was the case. I feel like we're going to be like 15 years, like another generation out from being able to properly retire them. But you never know. We might have something happen, like another... get another COVID where everyone's locked up at home and suddenly printers will be properly destroyed.
Mate, then you'll have everybody like buying their own Officeworks MFDs and then being like, how do I put MFA on this? And then you cry. You do.
I don't.
Yes. Tears occur. Literal tears. But I do say in there, the concept of follow me print, like authenticating to print, is a really good idea, because even just having that old, I printed to the wrong printer, is a recipe for destruction, no matter where you are. So being at least, at a minimum, if you're in an organization, you've got MFDs, make sure someone can swipe to make sure they print it wherever. Even aside from the fact that it's better to stop data being sent to the wrong place, it also means you don't even have to know which printer you have. You just go to any printer and swipe it and it pulls it down from the print server. I do remember hearing about a previous organization where they complained about it because the EA couldn't go grab the person's printing because they couldn't swipe for them, which I thought was funny, but increases your steps as well. So
I'm thinking back to when I did printing. So back when I was in government, that was all the time. I feel that I did struggle a lot of time with choosing the right network, like device and the network tabs in Microsoft Word, and not really knowing if it was supposed to go level 4, 6, 12, or which of the printers it would go to. When I went to Westpac, because they had a hot desking kind of arrangement, they did use that kind of tag. I just completely erased it from my mind until you brought it back up again, because I think I printed twice in my entire time. But both times, all I had to do really was go up and go beep, and then, you know, it just turned up, right?
That's it.
So I think it's, you use the card as like something you have instead of, and then it would require you to enter like a PIN from your phone as well or something. So they had MFA, like, there you go, look at the banks ahead of the time. The banks in 2019 already know how to do MFA for MFD. So those MFs.
Look, my personal recommendation is, even if you can, don't. Just stop printing and
just get away from it.
And if you can't stop printing, then definitely at a minimum have follow me print. That's probably enough of the old printer shenanigans.
Weapons of... Do we don't want any more printers?
No. The next section was guidelines for evaluated products and more critical control errors in this and more grammar updates. So thank you to the grammar lords for that. But the next section for me was more interesting because it has that AppSec feel, which is the guidelines for ICT equipment. This control 18757 is good because it basically notes that we should preference vendors with good secure by design principles. it's an aspirational control there. Reading through it, I actually thought, you know, this is one of those things that's great in principle, but hard to do. What was your feel having to read for it?
So for the audience, just going to read it out. It says, equipment is chosen from vendors to have demonstrated a commitment to secure by design and secure by default principles, use memory-safe programming languages where possible, secure programming practices, and maintain the security of their products. I mean, it sounds wonderful. I just have no idea how you're ever going to like test that people even do this, because if I think about, like, just if you go to vendor assessments, right? Have you really seen a successful third-party assurance vendor assessment in your career? Because I like Daniel Meisler's kind of take on it, which is pretty standard, is to ask someone if they've been breached and then ask them if they're an axe murderer. And if they say yes to either of those, then you probably need to think about another. Because, like, what are they going to come back with and just say, like, yes, we do every security, please buy our product. And also, it's too sensitive to show you. The other method is like, what, just go get a bunch of certifications like 27001 and say that, yeah, man, I've my attestation, letter of attestation, I'm not going to show you, but it's specifically for my dad's hen house. And, you know,
scoping's key. Scoping's always the key.
The scope, it's very important. The hen house is protected. See, we got 27001 compliance. We are a healthcare institution, but the letter of attestation for this, well, was one chicken in here and he's protected pretty good. So, you know, I don't understand how you could even apply that in software when, if you think about the kind of verification standards that are available, which should be like OWASP SAM or OWASP ASVS, like very few companies even remotely follow those, let alone would be audited against them. There's no kind of procurement thing. So what, they're going to just throw a bunch of static analysis reports at you or something and say, hey, look, we run a tool. Is this good? And then you look at it and you're like, ah, clang. Find bugs. That's from 1998. It's modern dev practices.
Yeah,
yeah.
as anyone knows who has even run automated code scanning against your own systems, actually reading it, making sense of it for yourself, and then contextualizing it from a risk perspective is hard. If it was easy, everyone would be doing it. So then extracting that out to make it so it's something that's consumable by a client to show to them that you've got secure by design or secure by default principles, like it's almost practically impossible. At the moment, from my understanding, I'd love for someone to write in and tell us how we're wrong and this is the thing. But if it's there, I'm not fully aware of it.
So like, I don't know any vendors who actually demonstrate any of these principles, right? Like the best I see is they say, I'm HIPAA, I'm FIPS, I have PCI DSS, I have SOC 2. But almost all of them usually have like a single piece within them that just says like do AppSec somewhere. There's no like secure by design, secure by default. Like it's messy, and you know, and also all of these, they're not really like not really indicative of the fact that that vendor isn't, you know, actually going to be secure. Like it's interesting to me to see use of memory safe programming languages, because that implies two things to me. Is either they can say, I am using C# and Java, which are full of, like, they manage the memory, right? So if they're like some backend service, then, you know, they have a lot of their own kind of problems within them, right? Or you can use something like Rust, in which case the product has basically got no memory issues, but it's never going to be built upon because it's built in Rust. No one knows Rust. So like, even if you use memory safe languages, they can just put the unsafe keyword in and start buggering around with pointers anyway. So that doesn't even protect.
Yeah, exactly. It is one of those things where I go, this is great, but it's probably just going to lead to more vendors having more buzzwords in their sales documentation, which says secure by design and secure by default. And then you just have to shrug and take their word for it. And we all walk forward into the CVE apocalypse.
I guess you can just send some kind of AppSec company out to audit every vendor on earth and then see if any of them are willing to even let you look at the source code, because I guarantee none of them are going to let me do that. So I don't want this guy going out there and seeing all my hard-coded credentials for all the production systems for all these government agencies. Like,
well, you do joke, but I do think that I'll put this down as a thought bubble, but the concept of a cyber coordinator or a whole of government cyber capability should be to be able to attest to this to some level for entities, and so that way an entity could write to them and say, hey, I want to apply to be accredited as secure by design, and they get someone in to do an assurance activity, and then they get put on a list. Now no one wants to maintain those lists. You could tell by the change to the SEC secure cloud list that got canned because it was too much work to have a central list. So I'm not saying it'll work, but for me, that would be the only way that this happens, where there's a central authority who just goes, yeah, we did this and these are the things that we did and we're doing it consistently for all of them. So that way, at least if you know if it's bad, it's consistently bad, or like if it's wrong, it's consistently wrong. But then also if it's right, it's consistently right. I think that would be a great way to do it.
So you just do IRAP, but it's ASRAP, right? Like AppSec registered assessors fresh.
Sure, I'm not even going to touch that with a barge pole. That
just is...
I don't know, man. Like, I feel like the biggest issue with this, if you do something like that, is just no one's...
The name? No, the name's not the biggest issue? No.
You know what, I'm happy. I used to live in a team that was called the ARS team until someone pointed it out to me. They were like, application security assurance or something. I was like, why are we ARS, right? So I was like, yeah, we should probably change that. So it's AppSec Assurance now, not Application Security Solutions or something. So yes, I've been in those boats before. So we will that's not our job. We're security professionals. We're not marketing people.
We come up with the ideas. They'll brand it.
They'll figure it out. They'll call it like the ACSC rep or something. So but yeah, man, like it's another thing I want to bring up about this one is that at least with most networking technology and operating systems and so on, is that they're relatively, you know, long shelf times and like lifetimes, and generally you can apply the same kind of auditing methodology over years. Whereas if I think about the programming languages I've had to pick up over the last 10 years, I made a mistake of being a Golang programmer in 2015, and now it's actually like kind of being great, and a lot of people are starting to use Protobuf and all sorts of cool things, right? Except I also remember specifically not choosing to learn Angular 2 or Solidity or, you know, Rancher and a million other things. So I don't know how you're going to be able to cover the broad scope of stuff unless you just pick C, C++, C#, Java, and hope for the best, right? Because it's just too much. And that's just languages. You've also got to do it for the types of software architecture and like systems that they use for building applications. So that's the CI. So that could be anything from GitHub Actions to Bitbucket pipelines to Azure DevOps to, I've just said all the Microsoft things, I guess. So, but like there's a million different ones available, like Travis and Jenkins, and, you know, it just keeps going. So, and SCMs and how you deploy it in cloud environments, because nowadays we write code to actually say what our cloud environments look like.
Yeah, infrastructure as code. Yeah.
So if you're a Bicep guy, or you're a Terraform dude, or...
Yeah, Ansible. Yeah.
Like Docker, Ansible, yeah, Puppet, whatever. I don't think there's any particular ability to just like get people to understand almost all of these technologies and the risk associated with them and stick them in a room and say, you need to audit everything everywhere. So
yep.
I would say, yeah, like this is more than likely going to end up with a framework like SAM, where someone comes along and says, tell me what you do for DevOps. And then you just see if they mention the word SAST somewhere, right? And then you can give them an extra point. And if they don't, you can take a point away, which is kind of what SAM does. So OWASP, SAM, S-A-M-M, Software Assurance Maturity Model. There's not a bloke called Sam who is part of...
Who's part of OWASP? Yeah.
I just call up Sam.
Sam, the head of OWASP. You just give him a call. Sam said it's okay.
You just give him a call and you say, hey, mate, I'm part of this like new IRAP kind of place, so you need to come out and do it, mate.
So you're saying any new assurance model should be someone's name?
Yeah, so we'll come up with the Toby assurance model soon.
It'll be named like hurricanes, just a name taken off the list that becomes the next one. we won't belabor this too much, but I think it's fine that we both broadly agree that it's good in intention, but almost impossible to enforce. So
yeah,
it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. The only other control that's been updated in that section is a great one, which is 1858, which basically just says, if you're going to put anything in and there's a guide on how to implement it at the ACSC, then follow their guide. That makes perfect sense.
Yes.
The next major guideline section is to system hardening, and there's a heap of minor wording updates in there. I don't want to talk about it in depth, but there is two control updates that I find great, which is 1795 and 1685, where they explicitly include breakglass accounts in the length and requirements for passwords, which means it seems self-evident. I would have said that breakglass accounts are privileged accounts, But the reason that I love this one is because then ISM control 1403 was also updated, which is the existing control relating to locking out accounts after a number of failed logins. And so they've updated that control to exclude break glass accounts.
Someone fat fingered and then got locked out of like AWS root account. And then, I don't know, some system was offline and everyone whinged for like a day. however long the lockout period was.
Yeah, look, it is good when you're basically telling them have super long passwords and then saying, hey, but maybe don't lock out your break glass after 5 goes because you've just given it a super long impossible password. And that's your final entry in. So I thought that was a fun little spicy piece in there. There is also 1861, which is a configuration piece around local security authority for auth protections for Microsoft, which if you've got Azure AD implementations or Microsoft implementations, I recommend you do it. The next major updates in guidelines for system management are all just wording updates. So we'll skip through them. Similarly, we've got guidelines for software development. They've got a new control that applies for web application firewalls, covering both the avoiding of disclosure of internet protocols and web services infrastructure forward. I'm not going to go to it too much in here because there is a massive section on DDoS, but it is really, you can see this is indicative of what happened, the updates as a whole. There was heaps of CCEs in the guidelines for emails, so heaps of wording updates. You don't need to talk about them, but the ones I would like to talk about next, and it's the last major section, is the guidelines for networking. So there are extensive updates here focusing on online service health and DDoS mitigation. A lot of controls talking about basically not allowing remuneration of your local resources, only using a CDN where possible, using various controls to protect against a denial of service event. I think these are very timely given that Russia's going a bit ham on denial of service across the Five Eyes at the moment. So there's some good takeaways here. What did you think about these updates?
It's about scale. A lot of it's the cloud environment scale. So I noticed that 1431 has changed a little bit, but it's in an important way where we see instead of having it just saying that cloud providers can dynamically scale, it says verified a cloud service provider can dynamically scale. I'm going to hazard a guess and say that a lot of the government systems haven't been architected in a way where you can actually scale. Because let's say you just go out and get an EC2 box, you do a lift and shift program, and you pick up your thing and you put in EC2 and you give it max. Well, how are you going to do load balancing and scaling it on beyond that? And the answer is probably not particularly well, because you've got a monolithic application that wasn't built for cloud services, right? And so that's why the verifying piece is very important, because they'd come back and say, hey, if you want this auto scaling thing, you need an ALB in the front. And you also need to actually find a way to distribute load between all your different EC2 boxes. And also, maybe you should consider not using straight EC2 and think about like serverless and actually architecting for a cloud environment. But also, that's very hard.
It is. If it was easy, everyone would be doing it.
You need to re-architect your applications. And yeah, it's, oh yeah, I mean, that's how I get paid big bucks, right? So it's because like it's an intense area. It changes a lot. And, you know, even if you're like a really good software like developer, like learning cloud in addition to that, it's a lot to go across. So yeah, I thought that one was really cool, because I feel there'll be a lot of, at least in my experience, there's a lot of people who misunderstand that AWS or Azure or Google, they just don't solve all your problems.
Mm.
You are basically paying for a box in a data center, or, well, more specifically, you're paying for like a portion of a supercomputery kind of thing in a little rack somewhere in a data center. You're not paying for them to manage like you would when you go to like a, you know, local provider like a NextDC or a Macquarie Telecom that actually physically manages boxes.
Yes.
Or if you have your own data centers, right? So, and you just make these assumptions about what people are in charge of, and then it falls apart when you get hit with 100 billion requests per second, right?
And it is interesting there, because there is a lot of really practical advice, like including 1581, where they talk about making sure you have continuous real-time monitoring of your environment, or that you have the ability to surge when you see attacks. And for me, actually removed wording around, they removed a control called 1518, which related to maintaining a pre-prepared low bandwidth version of your website, which for me, I think that's still a good control. It's kind of been rolled into 1431. And if you scale appropriately, you probably don't need this. But for me, it's still a good backup where you go, well, even if everything gets taken out, this is how we fail over to a known state. So you can point people towards that. I think that there's a lot of work to be done in this space. And as you said, as people move to these as a service models, increasingly things that were traditionally part of their big gateway vendors or that is going to be some entity with checkboxes having to configure it appropriately and maintain that configuration. And that's critical for both public and private sector people to think about.
The low bandwidth one, I think, is actually good to be removed. And I'm coming at it from a different view, which is that you basically don't need to maintain two versions of your application. And that is a lot to ask, because why not build an application that just actually considers, you know, bandwidth and like minimizing the ability for actual functional calls, you know, like go take that kind of content and get it run server side. If you're architecting, and again, it goes back to if you understand and build your application in a way where you're taking advantage of micro front ends and HTTP free, so you can actually do like be very sensible with your performance and what you're actually pulling down, then a lot of the having a need to maintain two different iterations of the website is not so important anymore, right? But again, you have to then have people going and building applications that are cloud native, and that's not so easy.
That's really fair, and I do think that when I think about it as well, that low bandwidth site to me is almost like a maintenance page.
Yeah, okay.
So that you can have some level of presence, but you're not intending to do a regular cadence to it, if that makes sense. It's not like your whole website, but without the login pages, it's just a 404 effectively, a pretty 404.
I feel like when you show those kind of things, though, what happens is a consumer navigates to it and then they get scared, right? You have a reputational like plummet. Whereas I feel like if the website's slow, they would just kind of forgive you a little bit and just be like, oh, these guys kind of suck a bit. So whereas if it comes up with a low bandwidth version, they'd be like, hang on, something's going on. Maybe I should call up the AFR, you know?
I smell a rat, they say.
Is this census fail again? Right, let's...
This seems like a failover. Yeah. Yeah.
So I feel like providing that that backup can be nice, but also like at the same time, it's probably better to just like focus on making your website as more resilient.
Make it work.
It's easier said than done, I know.
a lot of cyber controls are easy and hard to do. Basically brings us to the end. The guidelines for cryptography and the guidelines for data transfers both had some minor grammatical changes, which improve the readability, but don't change it overall. So for me, the updates really, the general impression away from the updates were that it focuses a lot on some aspirational pieces like the secure coding standards and the embedding of that into our procurement processes. But there's also on that back end a lot around how do you ensure that your websites and external services are resilient, and not just from the presentation layer, but also from the server back end, which I think is really, really critical.
Yeah, cool. So what was your favorite part of all of this, mate?
My favorite update had to be the fat fingering of the 30-character password for the break glass accounts, obviously. I do like that. It gave me a little bit of a chuckle, but all jokes aside, I really did enjoy the inclusion of security by design, even though I think it's impractical to enforce. Sometimes having it written down there forces people to think about it.
I mean, I feel like it creates a competitive like vector for entities to actually invest in security, right? Like if I'm in the private sector and I'm producing a software product to give specifically for government, by being able to market that I comply with this thing and giving practices, this means it could be the difference between my product getting selected and someone else's who choose not to do that kind of thing.
Mm.
So I feel like it will slowly start to make changes in the private sector when you are doing procurement for that, because it gives...
And mandating these concepts. Yeah.
It's a carrot. It's not a stick, this one, right?
Yes.
So like instead of forcing the government to actually go out there and like validate and verify that people are doing these things, instead, if someone does validate and verify, then it incentivizes people to pick it, right? So yeah, I feel like if we shift our perspective away from I'm going to look at this from a can I comply with this?
Compliance and implementability. Yeah, exactly.
Instead of a how do I get people who don't have to follow the ISM but would like to do it to change their behavior, then yeah, this I feel like it actually can be an effective control. So I like that one the best.
I agree. And I think that's a really great lens to look at it and probably to wrap up, because it's really how can the ISN then also promote better cultural change, even if it's in an indirect manner. And I think that this is one of the benefits of it. So again, from my side, I just wanted to thank everyone that contributes to the creation of the ISM. It's been, as you said, Cole, a vast improvement over the last, even the last couple of years. It's improved in leaps and bounds, but it's a completely different beast from what we had 5 or 6 years ago. And it is a critical resource for professionals to secure their organizations, not just government, but it is applicable to any entity around the world that would like to uplift the security of their organizations. Did you have any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I just want to thank you for coming on and, you know, giving your viewpoints about a lot of these as someone who's actually quite knowledgeable in the space. I thought it would be a really great topic to talk about. And I enjoyed going, you know, from turning the King James version back down to the pocketbook version. It's been a lot easier for me to digest. So I appreciate you giving up your time. And I also want to thank the ACSC for over the last, you know, 7-8 years, really improving the quality of this document. It's a lot better than it used to be. Thank you.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much, Cole, and hopefully I see you in 3 months when they release the next quarterly update.
Sounds good, mate. All right, catch you later.
Thanks, Cole. Ciao, mate.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Secured. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Don't forget to follow the podcast on your favorite platform and leave us a review. Want some more content like the above? Why not subscribe to our newsletter at galahcyber.com.au/newsletter and get high quality AppSec content straight to your mailbox. Stay safe, stay secure, and we'll see you next episode.
If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage, and I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galahcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn.